Well, thank you, Wes, for that introduction. Thank you for coming. And I'm going to be addressing the question specifically this lunchtime, does science disprove God? And the answer I'm going to give is no, as you're probably expecting from a Christian. But it's not the answer I always would have given. So when I began at university, age 18, going up to study natural sciences at Cambridge, I wasn't a Christian, as Wes has said. And in fact, I expressed my contempt for Christianity in a short poem that I wrote. Now, you need to understand that I was studying science, not English literature, and so my poem is rather limited in its kind of contribution to the English canon, but I do still remember it, and it went like this. Some folk seem to find it odd that people grow from tiny cells. Pathetic those who think of God and still drop coins in witching wells. There we are. That was my contribution to English poetry. But it does just capture something of what I thought about Christians back then. They find it odd that people grow from cells. I thought they must just be naive about the very basics of biology. I mean, sure, people used to believe that God made it rain with a giant watering can in the sky. But then we figured out about evaporation and condensation and the water cycle. People used to think that people got ill because of evil forces and got better because of miracles. But now we understand about viruses and antibodies and the immune system and so on. So surely still to cling on to these kind of superstitions nowadays, it must just be that they didn't understand about biology. Richard Dawkins famously likens it to clinging on to a belief in the tooth fairy, which is acceptable when you're age 8 or 9, but begins to look a bit embarrassing if you carry it into your later teens. About a month after writing that poem, I became a Christian, and everything in my life changed. I won't explain the whole story, but basically I met some Christians who didn't conform to my stereotype of Christianity. I'd assumed that Christians were gullible hypocrites. Gullible because I'd never heard anyone give me a reason why I should believe, and hypocrites because I didn't see any change in their behaviour to match up to what they said. But I met some Christians at university who weren't like that. They weren't gullible. Many of them were much brighter than I was, and they weren't hypocrites because they really lived out what they believed. And so through speaking to them and looking into it, and lots of struggle in my own head, I became a Christian. And I'm afraid I stopped writing poetry. But still, a science student. So I managed somehow to complete my science degree as a Christian. And then, as Wes said, I went on to do a PhD in auditory neuroscience, which sounds glamorous, but actually basically involved sitting in a soundproof room for the best part of 3 years listening to clicks. When I thought that was pretty bad, I spoke to a friend whose brother was doing a PhD in chemical engineering, sponsored by Hovis, and he spent the entire Christmas holiday looking at electron microscope slides of slices of bread and counting the bubbles. So, you know, that's the kind of harsh reality of science as actually practiced. But a scientist still, and yet a Christian. And that is the one thing that the modern atheists tell you that you can't be. A both and. Surely they say science or Christianity, it has to be either or. But I was a both and. And actually there's lots of both ands around. If you look at the history of science, maybe you know some of these household names of science. People like Isaac Newton, who formulated a theory of gravity. Michael Faraday, who discovered electromagnetism, electricity. James Clerk Maxwell, who did work on his famous Maxwell equations. People like Louis Pasteur, who discovered bacteria. Charles Babbage, who built the first computer. Some of the most famous names in science were at the same time committed Christians. In fact, according to one historian of science, Alfred North Whitehead, there was a connection between those two things. He writes this: man became scientific because he sought for law in nature. And he sought for law in nature because he believed in a lawgiver. In other words, it was because of the conviction in the 17th and 18th century that there was a God who had ordered this world in an intelligent way that people went about looking for intelligent order in the world. If they believed, as some do today, that the world is entirely random, it's questionable whether they would have bothered to try and understand what was essentially random. Now, they sought for purpose because of their conviction that there was a God who gave purpose. Well, that was true at the beginning of science, but you might say, well, what about nowadays? You know, now we've advanced a bit more. We've sequenced the human genome. We've put man on the moon. Maybe nowadays it's not possible to be a both and. Well, the first Sunday I was in church as a new Christian in Cambridge, I sat next to someone with an appropriately professorial beard, and it turned out to be Professor Bob White, a professor of geophysics at the University of Cambridge. My next door neighbour in Halls was studying paleontology. His supervisor was a man called Professor Simon Conway Morris, who it turned out was also a Christian. That's interesting, isn't it? Because people say you can't be a Christian because of the fossils, but Professor Conway Morris knows more about fossils than most people on the planet, and somehow he manages to be that one thing that the atheists say you can't be, a both and. Not just true of geology, it's true also of biochemistry. You may know the same year that Richard Dawkins published his book, The God Delusion, Francis Collins, the director of the Human Genome Project, published his book, The Language of God, in which he explains his faith in Jesus. Too many people who are both scientists and Christians. And I want to suggest today that is because there is no conflict between the two. There exists no conflict between them. That is so far as you conduct the experiment fairly. I mean, it is possible to cheat by defining science atheistically, so that the only kind of explanations or beliefs that you count as being scientific are those which are by definition atheistic. But all you've done in that case is just smuggled in the result at the beginning of the experiment. You've decided to put atheism in the beginning, and so you get atheism out at the end. But that's not really intrinsic to science. There's plenty of people who do their science without making those foundational atheistic assumptions. In the past, they never did. In the present, many don't. In fact, if we're to be more objective, what is science? Well, science really is just an apparatus of inquiry, a way of finding out about the world. We observe the world, we formulate a hypothesis to explain what we observe, and then by experiments we try to falsify that hypothesis and to refine it accordingly. And I know nothing about that methodology that argues against the beliefs of Jesus or requires a belief in atheism, nor do I know anything that has been discovered by that methodology. Any scientific data that argues against Jesus Christ. Of course, there is a conflict, we all know that, but I want to suggest it's not a science versus Christianity conflict. Rather, science is just a kind of a pursuit that can be shared by Christians and atheists alike, and Christians and atheists differ because of their philosophy or their worldview or their faith commitment. Now, I know that it would make someone like Richard Dawkins very angry to be told that he was a person of faith, and yet I submit to you today that, in fact, he is. There are certain things that he holds to that are not results of his science, but which he brings to the table as part of his overarching worldview. And those ideas, the philosophy of atheism, really is in conflict with the philosophy or worldview of Christianity. What I propose to do with the remainder of our time is to outline these two views and then to do what any responsible scientist should do and ask which one makes most sense of the evidence. So firstly, these two different philosophies. Now, of course, there are other philosophies beside these two. I'm not going to talk today about Hinduism or Islam or many other possible views, but just about these two that often go head to head in this particular debate in the secular media. Science on the one hand versus naturalism, atheism on the other. So very simply, what are they? Naturalism is the philosophy that says that matter and chance are all that there is. In the words of Bertrand Russell, the famous British philosopher, mankind is nothing but a chance collocation of atoms on a minor speck of interstellar dust. Now, the important words there are the words nothing but. As a Christian, I do believe we're made of atoms. I do believe that the Earth is a relatively small planet on the edge of a not particularly exceptional solar system in part of a Milky Way containing many, many thousands of stars, millions of stars. But according to Bertrand Russell, That is all that we are. Man is nothing but a chance collocation of atoms on a minor speck of interstellar dust. If you want to go even more depressing, you have to cross the channel and you meet the French existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre. He once said, every living being was born without reason, prolongs itself out of weakness, and dies by chance. So everything about your life, its origin and its end, is just randomness, purposelessness. And the only reason that you live day by day is because you are too weak to do anything else but propagate your own DNA. In my own field of neuroscience, the Nobel laureate, Francis Crick, puts it this way. You puts it in inverted commas because he's not really sure whether personality exists. You, your joys and your sorrows, your sense of personal ambition and free will are in fact no more than the behaviour of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Again, the operative words, no more than. As a neuroscientist, I believe that our thoughts have got something to do with electrons moving around in our brains. But according to Crick, you are reducible to that. You are no more than that. There's no soul, no purpose, no reason, just random electronic interactions. Well, that view, that philosophy of atheism, naturalism, does conflict very profoundly with the teaching of the Bible and of Jesus Christ. And I wanted to give you a little bit of the Bible in its own words, and you can see at the bottom of the little handout here, you'll see a little extract printed from a speech that the Apostle Paul, one of Jesus' first followers, gave in first century Athens. Athens in those days was the kind of intellectual capital of the day, and we're told that he got debating with some Epicurean philosophers. Now, I don't know much about Epicureanism, but I looked up in a dictionary of philosophy, and apparently the Epicureans believed that the gods were so remote that they played no role in human affairs on earth. Effectively, things were due to chance down here, and there was no survival at the end of death. So in some ways, Epicureanism a little bit like today's secular atheism. And this is how Paul explains the difference of the Christian worldview in that context. Let me read to you from the beginning of that passage. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. Just from that one sentence, I wonder if you can see that in some ways atheism and Christianity are the opposite of one another. Let me explain what I mean. If you said to Richard Dawkins, does God exist? He would say no, or actually, to be slightly more sophisticated, he would say, probably not, which is basically just another way of saying no. Does God exist? No. But does Christianity exist? Well, of course. No, he's not naive about a global, massive sociological system of belief. Christianity exists everywhere. It's a major force in the world, which he's doing his best to stamp out. If you could say, Richard Dawkins, where does Christianity come from? He would say, well, it's that's obvious. We invented it. We dreamt up the idea of a God, and we sustain and feed that idea. We build temples for this construct. It's entirely something of our own imagination and something which we sustain in being. And Paul says that is the opposite of reality. It's not as if there was a random Big Bang with no purpose, and then millions of years later, a random bacteria with no purpose, and billions of years later, it's become a random human being with no purpose, with random thoughts with no purpose, one of which thoughts is God. Now, it wasn't that we thought up God, but Paul says God thought up us. There is a God who gives all mankind life and breath and everything. He made the world. He sustains the world moment by moment. Absolutely the opposite of the atheist idea. And the question is, which one is true? Does it start with us by accident and the idea of a God? Or does it start with the personal, purposeful, powerful God who decided to make us? Very different ideas. Which one makes most sense of the evidence? I'm going to ask three different comparisons of them. You can see them on the sheet. And the first one is the longest, just to reassure you. So firstly, which one makes most sense of design? I've put it in inverted commas because the very term is offensive to the atheist who doesn't believe in design. But at least everyone agrees that the world looks as though it's been designed. It doesn't intuitively, as we gather here today, with human, human bodies and it's incredibly complex brains, it doesn't look as though it happened by accident. The cosmologist Sir Fred Hoyle once asked, what were the chances of life emerging by accident from the primordial soup? He said it seemed astonishingly unlikely. And the analogy he gives is of a whirlwind passing through a junkyard and happening to leave behind in its wake, entirely by accident, a fully functioning, fully assembled 747. It's possible, but pretty counterintuitive. But according to the atheist like Richard Dawkins, we have an explanation for it. This is what he writes in his book, The Blind Watchmaker, which was required reading for me when I went up to university. He puts it like this. Design, again with those inverted commas, design is only apparent. We have a mechanism to account for it. Natural selection. The blind, unconscious, automatic process, which we now know is the explanation for the existence of and apparently purposeful form of all life, has no purpose in mind. It has no mind, no foresight, no vision, no sight at all. If it can be said to play the role of watchmaker in nature, it is that of the blind watchmaker, hence the title of his book. So in other words, design is just an illusion, a trick that an uncontrolled, purposeless, random process called natural selection or evolution has played on us. We think we're designed, we're actually random. Now, rather than getting into the whole debate about evolution, which I think often can be quite fruitless, I want to just point out that even if you were to grant that natural selection is all that we need to get from a single-celled ancestor millions of years ago to a human being today, and I do want to say that that goes far beyond anything that has been demonstrated conclusively by the scientific community. But even if you grant that, that kind of leap, that's all we need, actually that hasn't solved the problem. Because in order even to get started with evolution or natural selection, you first have to have an information-carrying, self-replicating molecule. The simplest we know of is RNA, which is one of the most complicated molecules known to chemistry. So firstly, you've got to get this RNA molecule suddenly existing somewhere with some information on it to get copying to start to convey evolutionary advantages one generation to the next. And as to how you're supposed to get at that, science really is entirely guessing and has made no progress on that question really at all in the last 30 years. But actually, the problems start even further back than that, because you don't just have RNA, you also have to have a universe which can sustain a carbon-based molecule like RNA in the first place. And that is where the problems really start. The scientists tell us that to have a universe of the kind that life would be at all possible is very unlikely. Here are some numbers, not, by the way, from special Christian laboratories. These are just mainstream science numbers, granted widely. But they'll just give you an idea of just how finely tuned the universe appears to be to make life possible. Firstly, I don't know what all of these things mean myself, because I'm not a physicist, but just you'll get the idea of the scale. If the resonance between nuclear ground state energy levels of helium and beryllium was out by 1%, there wouldn't be enough carbon in the universe to sustain life. So 1 in 100, okay, it could be lucky, that's not too unlucky. But it gets worse. If the ratio of the nuclear strong force to the electromagnetic force differed by one part in 10 to the 16, then no stars could have formed. The odds are looking a bit worse now, but it gets worse. This is my favourite one. My second favourite one. If the ratio of the electromagnetic force constant to the gravitational constant were increased or decreased by one part in 10 to the 40, we'd have a universe containing either only big stars, too hot for life, or only small stars, too cold to manufacture chemical elements. And finally, there's been a lot of talk in the press recently about the view of inflation, the idea that just after the Big Bang, the universe expanded very quickly, and scientists think they found some evidence for this just recently. If the ratio of the expansion and contraction forces acting just after the Big Bang had altered by as little as 1 part in 10 to the 55, then the universe would either have expanded too quickly at the Big Bang so that all you'd have would be hydrogen atoms, no planets, no helium, no anything else, just spread out gas, or it would have expanded too slowly, in which case gravity would get the better of it, you'd have a Big Bang, and then it would collapse into a big crunch even before you got to 1 millisecond on your stopwatch. A universe, and then no universe again. In order to have any kind of universe that lasts for longer than a millisecond, that has stuff bigger than hydrogen gas in it, you've got to be accurate within 1 part in 10 to the 55. Now, that is a pretty small number. Just to give you an analogy, take a continent the size of America. I like these kind of examples. Take a continent the size of America, cover it with 5 penny pieces, stack them to a height of the distance between here and the moon, 380,000 kilometres away. Do the same for 1 billion other continents the same size, and paint one of the 5 penny pieces red with nail varnish. Blindfold your girlfriend, your wife, husband, get him to pick one at random, and it's about 1 in 10 to the 40 that he'll get the right one. In other words, about 1 million, million, million better odds than getting the right expansion rate at the Big Bang. In other words, it all seems very, 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 very unlikely. Very lucky. This is even before you started evolution. Very, very big questions to ask for the atheists. Well, actually, realising it's so unlikely, the latest kind of answer from the atheist camp has changed. So now it's popular to hear people speak about a multiverse. The idea being if you do the experiment infinitely many times, if there's infinitely many universes, one of them is going to get lucky. But actually, the problem with the multiverse is, as one scientific reviewer pointed out, the multiverse isn't an observable or a repeatable or a testable theory. It's interesting, but it can't really properly be called a scientific theory. You can't go about assessing it in the way that we assess science. So at best, it's a faith position. I believe, I choose to believe or exercise my faith in a multiverse because I don't want to exercise my faith in a God. Actually, it seems to me that to believe in a multiverse requires rather more faith than to believe in an intelligent God, because if there's infinitely many universes, then everything that's happened isn't that unlikely because it's also not happened in another version of the universe. You can explain everything because there's just enough rolls of the dice that everything has happened somewhere. So as well as the version of the universe in which I finished this talk, there's the version at which I drop dead now. No, we're not in that version of the universe, much to your disappointment perhaps. As well as the universe at which you won at Monopoly last night because you had a hotel on Park Lane, there's the universe at which your wife had a hotel on Park Lane and she won. And then there's the universe at which you won with a hotel on Mayfair, and the universe at which she had a hotel on Mayfair. And basically everything that happened to you also didn't happen to you in another version of you, in another version of the universe. This, for me, begins to require quite a lot of faith. The alternative, perhaps the universe is finely tuned because there is a God who made the world and everything in it. Perhaps he set the numbers for the expansion of the universe. Perhaps he put the information into the RNA molecule for the life forms he wanted. Perhaps he guided and brought about the emergence of humanity and our intelligent minds created in his image to be personal and capable of self-understanding in a unique way amongst the animals. Maybe that makes more sense, actually, of the facts of science, the Christian view. Much more briefly, which one makes most sense of human life as we live it? The philosopher John Gray, you may have come across his book Straw Dogs. He's not a Christian, but he's a well-known modern philosopher. He chastises atheists for failing to live their beliefs through to their logical conclusion. And others for being hypocrites. I used to hate hypocrisy when I found it in religious people. And if you hate religious hypocrisy, you're in good company, because Jesus despised it more than almost anything. But John Gray says the trouble is the atheist also is guilty of hypocrisy, because he or she won't live out what he says that he believes. He says we must realise that we live in a world where our existence is entirely accidental, And as such, it is indifferent to our suffering as it is to our hopes and our crimes. The universe is random. It just doesn't care about the things that you care about. I was once talking to a fellow academic when I was doing my PhD, a lady called Kate, one of the professors. And I said to her, Kate, tell me why killing you would be wrong on your understanding of the universe. In particular, why would killing you be any different to cutting a grapefruit in half for my breakfast? You know, all I'd be doing in both cases would be rearranging the atoms of the universe in a slightly different way. Much the same kind of thing. Kate atoms, grapefruit atoms, just arranging them differently. And, you know, we were good friends. This wasn't an actual threat, just an example. And she said to me, well, the difference is my mother would be upset. Good answer. But then I said to her, Kate, what's upset? Upset is just the change in the concentration in a particular neurotransmitter in the randomly assembled collection of atoms, which is your mother's brain. Why does that matter? Well, of course, people would give answers like they'd say, well, it's because of sociology. We've evolved to care about each other. The trouble is that what we think matters reduces to something that doesn't. Sociology is just the product of lots of brains in the same room. So really, sociology is reducible to neuroscience. So please can the neuroscience department have all your funding. Thanks very much. But brains are just complicated mechanisms of chemicals. So neuroscience reduces to chemistry. Chemicals behave as they do because of the underlying subatomic forces. So chemistry reduces to physics. And physics, we're told, reduces to the Big Bang, which happened by accident. So what we think matters reduces to something that doesn't. The personal reduces to the impersonal. The apparently purposeful reduces to the random. And you cannot give an account of why your life matters at all. But the Christian can make sense of this notion we have that life's important. Because there is a God who made the world and everything in it, who gave to all mankind life and breath and everything. And I just want to show you one other thing in this reading. Just look down at verse 27. God's purpose in making the world. It's quite astonishing, I think, this. God made the world, sentence 27, in order that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way towards him and find him. In other words, according to the Christian view, God's not just there to kind of press go on the computer program or to make the Big Bang go bang, and then that's his job done, to sit back. Rather, God made the world in order to know, to relate to personally, the creatures that he'd made. Isn't that an astonishing thought? I wonder if you're even open to that possibility. The trouble is, when it comes to getting to know people, and getting to know someone relationally, science is out of its depth. It's not that science isn't powerful. Science is a very useful and powerful tool. But it can't tell you everything that's important. And in particular, when it comes to getting to know people, it's quite limited. Which is why I very much doubt that on your first date, you just said to your partner, please can I take a small DNA sample? I'll run some tests. I'll be back with you with a decision in a couple of weeks. I doubt that's how it works. I mean, let's suppose you wanted to get to know me, but all you had to go was what you could find out from scientific experiments. What could you find out? You could do gas chromatography under my armpits. You could tell me what deodorant I'm wearing and whether or not it's coping with this slightly stressful situation in which I find myself. You could take a DNA sample and run some tests. You could compare it with the Interpol most wanted database. Or you could tell me perhaps my propensity to die early from some known genetic illness. But that's really about all you could tell me. You couldn't tell me my name. You couldn't tell me what I care about, who I love, what I would die for. In fact, almost anything of any importance to me as an actual person is beyond you. Not because science isn't important. It's just that science can't tell you everything that's important. When it comes to getting to know a person, it struggles. But when it comes to know a divine person, a God, it's even more out of its depth. How do you take a DNA sample from God to do your tests? If God is everywhere, if this is the universe that God's in, how do you get rid of him from the universe to take a null reading as a control, to compare? Excuse me, God, please could you leave and we'll just see if it makes a difference. How could you even do that experiment? The only way you could get to know God is if God decided to make himself known to us. And the Christian claim is that is exactly what he's done in history. That Jesus Christ, who made the universe, was born as a baby in the universe. He lived and he died and he rose again. You'll notice there on verse 31, right at the bottom of the reading. God has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man he's appointed. Of this he's given assurance to all, or proof to all, by raising him from the dead. That was a surprise to me as an atheist, to discover in Christianity an appeal to evidence. Something that would assure you or prove to you that this was real. God isn't into people kind of taking steps of blind faith in the dark with closed minds. He wants us to look at the evidence and follow it where it leads. There was a man in history called Jesus Christ who claimed to be the God who made the world. And he lived and he died and he rose again. Now, when it comes to the resurrection, the God delusion, Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, discusses it only once in order to say that it cannot have happened, being in its very nature a violation of the laws of biology. But actually, that isn't the way that science works. Science doesn't decide its conclusion first and then ignore contrary evidence. In fact, the contrary result is very important in the progress of science because it tells you that something's wrong with your theory in the first place and it needs to be adjusted. But Richard Dawkins at this point isn't a reputable scientist because he's already decided that he's got a prior faith commitment to his atheism. It doesn't matter what happened 2,000 years ago. This cannot have happened, regardless of the evidence, because my faith in atheism is absolute. Well, I want to ask you whether you're willing to be a bit more open-minded than that, and to do the experiment, and to look at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And if it happened, atheism has to go. Can't make any sense of a resurrection in a random, purposeless world. But it does make sense if there is a God who made the world and everything in it, who gives to all mankind life and breath and everything else, and who wants you to reach for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. Thank you very much for listening, and do come and grab me if you have questions afterwards.